What's up and welcome back to Kinda Funny's Christopher Nolan in Review. That's right, we're ranking, reviewing, and recapping every Christopher Nolan movie. Of course, I am Tim Geddes, and I'm joined by the Nitro Rifle, Andy Cortez.
Hello.
It's Christmas in July. Joey Noel.
Hello.
And rounding out the group today, the producer slash seducer, Nick Scarpino.
Hello.
I love that. And I love In Review. We just get together every week, talk about movies, rank them, review them, recap them. And what a time it has been. Pretty much every week. You guys, the journey's about to come to an end, all right? We've been, I feel like the four of us, for the most part, have been in it week to week to week to week, never missing a theater experience.
This has been the review season for us.
It has been wild, yeah. Man. Like, legitimately, like, I don't think in history there's been this much, like, back-to-back movies worth going to see in the theater. And it's been absolutely incredible. So you guys can check out In Review. We've done every massive franchise there is the last couple weeks. This is an interesting one, though, because we're doing, obviously, Nolan in Review, because we've been doing that forever, so we have to include Oppenheimer. But a lot of people are like, how are you guys going to cover Barbie? Of course we're going to do Barbie. We're kind of funny. We have some super fun plans for that. So this is going out this week. Next week, we'll be doing Barbie. We're going to be doing a special Monday slot of recording for people on Patreon, and then it'll record Tuesday morning for everybody else. But we have some really fun things planned for that, so I'm excited for you all to see that. And you're definitely going to need a little bit of fun, a little bit of a palate cleanser after this one, because I feel like it's a bit heavier of a movie. We're going to have a lot of fun talking about it today. But of course, this is Kinda Funny's In Review. Like I've been saying, ranking, reviewing, recapping movie franchises. If that sounds cool to you, this is the place you want to be. YouTube.com/kindoffunny, roosterteeth.com, or podcast services around the globe. If you want to go even further and help us more, you can go to patreon.com/kindoffunny, just like our Patreon producers, James Hastings, Casey Andrew, and Nathan LaMothe have done.
Thank you.
We appreciate all of you so very much. Today we're brought to you by Liquid IV, but Patreon people won't need to hear that ad. But yeah, like I was saying, it's been week after week after week of stuff, and the blockbuster season is coming to an end. We have Oppenheimer, Barbie, we still have Ninja Turtles, we still have Blue Beetle, and that's kind of the end. And then it's like there's a scattering throughout the year of a couple movies coming out, but like it's wild that it's over.
Yeah, we've been doing some research because we have the next version of our movie draft for the year coming out for Patreon people in like a couple the next week or so. But as I was like researching what's coming out for the rest of the year, a lot of indie movies, yep. Not a lot of like big hitters, some interesting ones. But I feel like we have a break until we get to like the end of the year when I feel like that's the little baby resurgence of everything.
I'm looking forward to like a chiller theater experience of being able to let's just go watch a smaller comedy. Or what's the one with Jennifer Lawrence that just came out?
Hard to Kill.
Yep.
Is it like the No Hard Feelings.
Yes. Things like that. Like,
I'm No Hard Feelings.
And getting in there and giving him a shot. But we'll have to wait for all of that. Sorry. I should have mentioned this. Secret Invasion review on the MCU side. We will be doing that. So we're kind of backed up a little bit. So Nolan in Review this week, Barbie next week. The week after that, we're going to be starting it off with Secret Invasion with Nick, Andy, and Greg joining me to give our full thoughts and ranking it against the rest of the MCU. So get excited for all of that. But today, we are talking about Oppenheimer with a runtime of 3 hours on the dot. It's exactly 3 hours. A release date of July 21st, 2023, which will go down in history as Barbenheimer Day, the day that both Barbie and Oppenheimer came out. It's Nolan's first film not to be distributed by Warner Brothers domestically or internationally since Memento, as well as his first film to receive an R rating since Insomnia in 2002. It was directed and written by Christopher Nolan, based on American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, a 2005 biography of the theoretical physicist. I just want to stop right here and just say, Christopher Nolan, man, how the hell does he make all these movies, direct them, but write them? Like, how do you write this movie and Dunkirk and Interstellar and Inception and The Dark Knight? Like, it's just... He's so smart. Yeah. I'm so stupid.
Yeah, you're just so dumb. Tenet, like right there.
Well, did Tenet too. Hey, look.
All right, there you go.
Look, there's
did he write Tenet or did Tenet write itself?
Oh wow,
good question.
There's nothing that makes me feel dumber than knowing that these. Not only are they incredibly creative, right? Like Christopher Nolan is one of these that will be on the Mount Rushmore, I think. But Not like the actual Mount Rushmore, not of entertainment, like the actual, they're going to replace one of those.
Oh, you think they're going to take Washington off?
Yeah, yeah, replace Washington. But just the amount of education and research that has to be put into the subject matter, like it's wild to just write a good movie and a good script about your friend from high school, but it's even crazier to do that about stuff like this that requires a shitload of research and a massive team of people to tell you what's wrong. And then you might have a really cool plot point. Oh, but we'll hit this thing. Oh, but that doesn't make sense scientifically. Shit, never mind that. Like, all that blows my mind, dude.
And you have to make it easily understood by a bunch of dum-dums. Yeah. Like, I think that's the craziest balance, is like making something that has to be so accurate to an extent. I'm sure there's inaccuracies because it is a movie. But to have it be such a high-level thing but also need to be understood by general moviegoers, I am just so impressed. Nick, you were about to say something?
Oh, I was going to say, well, I mean, you know, the science behind it and the actual events behind it, I think, are the easy part, because it's based on history and multiple books that I'm sure have been written about Oppenheimer. That stuff's the easy part. The thing that I thought I had feared that Nolan was going to fail at was weaving in the rest of the politics behind it. And I think he did a really, really good job of keeping, like, because at one point we're switching times between like five or six different eras back and forth. And so visually and both makeup wise, costume wise, and just how they did all that stuff, I thought was actually really well done.
Yeah. The music was done by Ludwig Göransson, who's just rising the ranks to GOAT status day by day, Andy.
Unbelievable.
But I never thought we'd get a Ludwig and a Nolan collaboration. Although, wait, did he do Tenet as well? I don't remember. Tenet feels like
I can look that up.
A blip, but it's just, I just love it. I love seeing him get these big swings, and I think he did a great job with this one.
Yeah, he did Tenet.
Oh, okay, awesome. Yeah. Yeah. So this one, a budget of $100 million. $100 million.
How?
Barbie. Guess the budget of Barbie.
150.
Double that.
145.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just like, wow. It's just surprising. Very surprising. Having said that, there's no box office now because the movie's already been out, but the projections, clearly Barbie's through the freaking roof. Like, Barbie is like
a little bit more commercially viable film.
Extremely well. But this is crushing too. It's essentially sold out. And I think a lot of that has to do with how much they're pushing the big prestige format stuff of the IMAX. If you could watch this in IMAX, watch this in IMAX. We are so lucky that we got to see it in true, proper 70mm IMAX. I've never seen anything like this, man. Like, holy crap. The visual quality of this shit was, like, just completely unrivaled. Like, Nick, were you impressed with this?
Yeah, very much so. Almost more so than when we saw Interstellar in IMAX, which had a very similar vibe to it. I think he's just really, like, he loves film, obviously. He picks different formats, sometimes because I think he thinks it's going to work well with narrative, but also sometimes it can be kind of gimmicky. And this one, I think he really, really was like, look, this movie needs to be big. It's about this incredibly, probably arguably the most historic event that's ever happened in humanity, and 70mm format for this, when it fills the screen, feels right for that. And you sit in that theater, and when you see those moments where it fills the entire screen, you feel the magnitude of what's about to happen and what really happened in real life, and it just works so well. I thought this movie was beautifully shot, almost more so than any other movie he's ever made. Probably this might be his most beautiful film.
Yeah, it definitely was a spectacle. It was all shot on 65mm and 65mm large format film, including for the first time sections in IMAX black and white analog photography. That's why the black and white stuff had such a like unique look to it. It didn't just look like a filter or like, you know, like,
oh yeah, she shot the scenes in black and white.
It was like, it looked like so damn good. And as with his previous works, Nolan utilized extensive practical effects and minimal computer generated imagery. One of the cooler things going around is that, like, of course there's CGI. There's CGI and everything. Like, CGI is such a blanket
statement.
That's
like compositing, though, and all that.
Exactly. Damn. But in terms of, like, none of the shots in this movie were, like, full-on computer-generated. Like, the bomb that went off was a real bomb that went off. The flames that we saw, the stars, all that stuff, those were real, man. And, like, that just blows my mind. It just makes it all so much more special to see on such a big screen.
They did a lot of that stuff, too, right, where you could tell a lot of the sparkling stuff, a lot of, like, the visuals they used to, like, represent the atoms and, like, the stardust and, like, all these moments of, like, fusion and implosions and explosions. All that stuff, in my brain, I'm like, I don't know if that's what that really looks like. but it's so visually haunting and beautiful that it works to get across what they're trying to get across. And they could have very easily, this could have very easily been like The Core. We're like, all right, let's just visualize with this, you know, like really shitty CG.
The core.
Well, you know, go like you get bad CG, bad moments Michael that just kind Bay of take you out of this. But instead, he was like, hey, we're not gonna blow up a nuke. Right, we don't have that, like we can't go that real with it. But what can we do that simulates that or gives the feel of it? And a lot of this movie felt like we were in this sort of surreal period when those moments happened, which is very, very artistic and very, very cool. Like, I don't know if that's what that stuff, I mean, obviously a bomb looks like a bomb, but like I'm talking about the moments where like it was a sparkle like stardust and all these mm-hmm. things, you know, those little atom moments and all that stuff. Like all that stuff, I don't know if that's accurate or not. I don't care. It works so well and it just lends itself this like this sort of like, for lack of a better term, like quantum mechanic version of what's happening, meaning I don't know what the hell any of that is. I don't know if I'm supposed to understand what that is, but I get the feeling of mm-hmm. what it is.
Yeah.
And that's why that, I mean, and just shout out to Hoyt Van Hoytema that shot all this, who was his Nolan cinematographer that he's worked with a lot, because he nailed it.
Yep. So let's get into our thoughts on this movie. Andy Cortez, I want to start with you. What do you think of Oppenheimer?
I thought it was dreadful and beautiful, and I think the number one thing I could say about it is like I was captivated the whole time. I never felt bored. I never checked my watch. I was just in that experience with everybody else in that theater, and it was a jam-packed IMAX. Like this was one of
every seat was taken.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it was made better because I got the TMNT Green Apple Slushy.
But without the thing, right?
They didn't have Pop Rocks. Nope. They didn't have the Pop Rocks. So I mix in some cherry.
I can't think of a drink that I can picture Oppenheimer drinking more than that.
Yeah, dude.
I got the Green Apple Slushy. Let me tell you what. Dealing with some massive like chest and stomach problems last night because I got a lot of I ate a lot of Airhead Stripes, the Airhead Extremes. Felt awful. this morning I was like, I think I'm dying. Like I cannot sleep right now. I am like having trouble. Like I feel like I'm gonna vomit. Anyway,
Andy, I appreciate you handing those over to me.
Yeah,
you need to stop.
Is that what happened to you? Because I heard you and I smelled you smacking those things. But I had delicious. A buffer. D came with us and she was sitting between us, and I didn't want to embarrass myself by asking my wife to ask Andy if he could please hand over the Airhead.
Oh, that's your line.
Yeah.
It's good. Now we finally know where Andy's line is.
Some more movies with us?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. She just can't be bothered. She can't be scheduled, yeah.
Yeah, I think this movie, like Nick mentioned, was shot impeccably. This is like, I think the purest form of what Christopher Nolan wants to, like, this is like his art. This is like the purest form of art that he could put on screen. And being there in that theater with everybody else, feeling the dread, feeling the sometimes happiness, because you know the Nolan I think does a decent job of like, you know, peppering in some nice little one-liners every once in a while, and I always think they're like really aptly placed. But I think the cast in this is phenomenal. I think Robert Downey Jr. was fucking great. I think Cillian Murphy was incredible. Everything was like so pitch perfect. And then the final act of the movie begins, and it's like a movie unto itself. And you're wondering, like, oh shit, there's still a lot more left of this. There's about an hour left of this movie. Should it have ended at the 2-hour mark? And I think the rest of it is still done so incredibly well. And I think more than anything, what I told Tim and Kevin last night, this felt like a 3-hour long trailer. This was cut like a trailer. While I was sitting there watching it, it's like it was relentless in its pace. It is just, there is music happening in what seems like 98% of the movie. Constantly driving the dialogue forward, constantly having these characters go back and forth. And then I think more than anything, though, this movie, like, I need to watch it again with subtitles, because there are a lot of names, there are a lot of characters, there are a lot of historical figures that are being kind of just thrown in there, and I'm forgetting what name was what person in the movie. So I had some trouble with that, kind of bringing in all that information. especially when we get to the final act where it is very much this guy said this thing about this person.
Was that a lie? Was this true?
Like, it becomes a court case that about characters that I
for this. Yeah, all the pictures.
It becomes a court case about characters that I feel like I didn't know a whole lot anyway. And now it became like super integral of having to know whose side was on whose and who was double crossing who and everything like that. And that stuff I'm just extremely ignorant about. I don't remember anything about this stuff in history class, just because I don't remember a whole lot of anything in any of my classes. I don't think any of us
had a specific history class on the formation of the atomic bomb.
I imagine it was a little byline class session.
I think this is like a must watch in IMAX. I think this is one of Christopher Nolan's finest works that he's put out. This is not the movie you go watch though to, you know, hey, maybe I don't have a whole lot of interest in Interstellar, but or in space, but I'm going to watch Interstellar anyway because like of the visuals and it having like this sort of sci-fi kind of vibe to it. This is like as nonfiction I think any of his works can get. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know,
Dunkirk was nonfiction.
Dunkirk may have had some embellishments when it comes to action and things like that, sure. Right? But I think this is the one that like impresses me the most because of its subject matter. This movie was very, very impressive, and you feel like shit walking out of the theater because you just have all this weight on you. And but it's kind of what I wanted to feel when I walked out. I told Barrett and Tim that like the way I felt walking out of that theater is how I was hoping to feel. I wanted to feel like I didn't want this to steer into like, not war porn, but like the glorification of war and the arms race and everything like that. There are moments where it treads into that because it's kind of making a point. And yeah, I think this movie is incredible.
Nick, I want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm with Andy on this one. I mean, to say that it's entertaining is not something you can really, it's not a word you could use to describe this. It's riveting. It's haunting and it's beautiful, but it's everything that you would a movie of its ilk and caliber would demand of the subject matter. You walk out and it is a gut punch, and you can't help but think of things like AI and the current arms race that's happening with that, and what the implications of that are going to be as we go forward. Because as we look back into this, you're seeing a lot of that history being repeating itself right now. I really, really enjoyed it. I think. To Andy's points, I enjoyed Dunkirk, but I think just because the subject matter of this is a little bit more familiar and way more, I think, unfortunately, relevant to the entire world, you can't help but be riveted by this. And I think just he skates that line between being intrigued by the science and then being horrified by the morality of this whole thing, the entire movie. And you see that in Oppenheimer. You see that mirrored in what he's feeling and what he's outwardly pushing toward everyone, the confidence of being this like cult-like leader in New Mexico versus what he's inwardly feeling, which at one point I was like, is that the same effect they use this when the scarecrow does the
background stuff?
But all that stuff really, really worked because that's what the movie's about, right? The movie's about like, was this inevitable? And once we hit that path, what are the implications of this worldwide? Like, should we ever use this? I loved all that discussion. I loved them just sitting in a room, the scene where they're talking to the secretary to the president, and he's like, we're using this on Japan. And Oppenheimer's like, we shouldn't. We should share this with our allies. This is an opportunity for us to like share this and like be and have an open dialogue about all this. And the guy's like, nah, we'll just bomb Japan with it. And we'll
Kyoto, because that's where me and my wife went to vacation. Yeah. Like,
what a fucking punch.
Which is wild, right? But then the discussion of having like, wait, you're going to drop two? He's like, well, yeah, one shows that we have it and two shows that we're willing to use it whenever. And then, I mean, all of that stuff to me is absolutely fascinating. And that's its own debate that I think they had a lot in this. And they had a lot of great debates in this. But ultimately, you know, this is one of those movies that I think should be required by everyone to go see. You should go see it in 70mm. You should allow yourself to be kind of punched in the gut by just the sheer importance and magnitude of it. And then, you know, maybe walk out of that and be like, how can we stop this from ever happening again? What can I do on a personal level to make sure we don't do this? Because there's a lot of things happening right now that, you know, are relevant for that today. But ultimately, incredible cast, incredibly shot, incredible experience. One minor critique, I don't think it needed to be 3 hours long. I think it's a wonderful movie. And if I were Christopher Nolan, I can see why he would put all this in there. But I do think you could have cut probably an hour out of either the beginning of it or the end of it and still made the statement that you wanted to make with all this. But that is a minor critique for a movie that's 3 hours long. I only had to go to the bathroom one time, and when I came back, I was riveted all the rest of the way. So, very good movie. Joe.
Also, my first time on Nolan in Review.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you. What a fun one. I think riveting is like the perfect word. I think the biggest compliment I can give is that Christopher Nolan made me really invested in a story that before this I just truly did not care about at all, or didn't think I cared about. And I think the cast for this is just incredible across the board. Cillian Murphy, excellent. Robert Downey Jr., excellent. This is my favorite kind of ensemble movie, where for like the first, it seems like hour and a half, every 5 minutes, you're like, oh, that guy's in this, and oh, that guy's in this.
Dude, when Josh Hartnett popped up, I was like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Josh Hartnett.
And Dave DeHaan, I was like, okay. Right? Yeah.
I know, it's crazy. And even the, like, his, not second in command, but like the guy that he meets on the train at the beginning.
Matt Damon?
No. The guy that like beats him weirdly, they like bond over both things.
Oh, the guy, yeah, he's been in a bunch
of things that hate about you. Yes. He's Joseph Gordon-Levitt's little friend and stuff like that. So
and the Santa Claus?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, he's the elf. He's the main elf. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just so fun to
Bernard.
Yeah. To constantly be peppered with like all of these, and it's like, oh,
that's a great performance.
The president from Scandal, Tony Goldwyn, who's incredible. Like. Perfect has the perfect.
I love that. That's your touchdown for Tony.
I know it's not Ghost.
Mine is Ghost.
I just watched Scandal earlier this year, but he has like the perfect like tone of voice and cadence and acting ability for like political roles, and I just think that he's so good in the little bits that we get in him. It's crazy the way that Christopher Nolan is able to build tension. Like the middle act or the second act, middle hour of this movie is so tense, and I feel like I was reacting to a lot of things the same way that I do in scary movies, of just being like, I can't watch this, but I can't not watch this, and how do I contain that internally? And I haven't felt like that in a non-thriller scary movie. I don't know ever the way that I felt in this movie. I disagree with you. I think that the 3-hour runtime really worked for me.
You're for it.
Yeah. I do think that it's crazy. We always have to manage the bathroom in these like 3-hour movies. And I remember we got through, the first 2 hours. And I asked him, I was like, how much longer do we have left? And it was like, oh, we have an hour. Like, dang, this feels crazy. But
it feels impossible.
Like what possibly could we have to do for an hour? But I think it's equally as riveting as the first 2 hours and the buildup for all of that. I am just like really constantly impressed by Christopher Nolan. Like, I think that they're on the list. I was looking at your guys' rankings. I think there's like 2 or 3 that I haven't seen, but truly they're all, most of them. All but I just have one that I don't like.
I was thinking, Joe, that like my biggest worry of it was that it was going to be more biopic than Nolan artsiness.
Yeah.
And we got plenty of Nolan creativity and artsiness throughout that was like really impressive, and again all the cutaways to those close-up shots of the atoms and the noise, that just like the sound design was just like so frenetic and a great way to kind of cause tension in the audience as well. And I thought they did such a great job. And then the scenes where he's in the cockpit looking at the missiles flying, like all of that stuff is what I'm so happy was there, because I thought this was going to be just a lot more straightforward in ways that I wasn't really wanting, because I'm used to Nolan being this visionary that can do wild stuff, practically, especially hearing like, hey, no CGI. Of course, there's going to be like compositing, and sure, we'll make those mountains in the background dark or whatever. But like, I was worried about hearing no CGI. Oh, damn, what's that going to do to like, how are we going to see the Nolan in this movie? And I think that there was plenty present throughout its 3-hour runtime. And yeah, it's so impressive. Tim, what were your thoughts?
I mean, I'm right there with you with just jumping off of this point. Like, it was that 2-hour mark where all of a sudden it's like, hey, motherfuckers, surprise. It's a Nolan movie.
Yeah.
We're getting the reveals. We're getting the twists. The music's playing. Like, this was the plan all along. But it didn't feel weird. It felt earned, and it felt like the tension is built to this point beautifully. Right there with you on all this stuff. Like, this is a masterpiece of a film. It is far from my favorite Christopher Nolan film, but that's just because I like cool, fun,
the nerdy
twists
shit.
And stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I feel horrible leaving this. And, like, that's not, you know, my favorite thing. I'm right there with Nick. I think that this is the type of required movie that, like, you need to just sit down and just watch it, and you're going to be captivated. Like, we've used words like captivated, riveted, like, all of us. And it is so true. It's rare, like, especially in the IMAX theater. Like, I like to sit in the back so you, like, see everything. So you see when anybody gets up to go to the bathroom. And, like, our IMAX in San Francisco, like, the seats are really close to each other, so there's a lot of the old school theater, like, kind of, like, walking by. This is the least I've ever seen people go to the bathroom in a movie.
Same.
And it was a 3-hour fucking, like, quote-unquote boring movie. That means it's not boring. That means that they did their job, and it is captivating. I was so shocked. I was so surprised, but they did it. And I think from the first shot to the last shot, I was just there. I'm kind of in the middle of Joey and Nick on, like, I do think that a lot could have been cut, but I feel like them not cutting it and it being 3 hours is part of what makes it this, like, the I don't even want to say slow burn. It's just a burn. It's just a long burn. But
epic.
I feel like it's an epic. Mm-hmm. But I think that it almost feels less like a movie to me and more like the highest profile HBO series just presented in one long feature, and that really worked for me. Like, I the entire time, like, I feel like there's, like, very clear kind of points of, all right, cool, now we're moving into this act, and it felt like arcs in a season of TV show, and it worked so well. But to Nick's talking about the entertainment value, like, not being there compared to a lot of the other Nolan features, which is very apt and fair for what this is. To me, the entertainment 100% came from what Joey was talking about. The cast. Not only was every 5 minutes there some new cast member, and me not seeing the trailers or not seeing too much about this movie, I think added to this a lot. I've heard a lot of people are in it. I didn't know that half the people that were. I'm not sure if some of these are, like, actual surprises people don't know about, which we've seen before in Nolan movies, like Matt Damon being a big, like, whoa in Interstellar, right? But the entertainment to me was how I think, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong on this about anything, I think that every single character that came up wasn't just like, oh, this is cool, you're here. It's like, oh, wow, this is the best role you've ever fucking had. You were acting, my friend. Yeah. I feel like Florence Pugh might be the only one that, I'm not saying she wasn't great in this, I'm just saying she's so great in so many things that I can't say this is definitively better,
like,
than others.
Like a standout, yeah.
But I think every other actor, I'm like,
Emily Blunt in the second half.
Oh, my God.
Just really bringing it.
And, like, even people we know that could bring it just brought it that much more. But, like, Cillian Murphy, man. Robert Downey Jr. is going to get talked about all the live long day, deservedly so, especially for someone we're so intimately familiar with, being Iron Man. He was transformed. Like, that is just wild to me that somebody that we know so well can be this completely different character. And even in this, seeing how much he changes was so impressive. But Cillian Murphy, the amount of this film that's just him, and him just either saying things or not saying things, but having to deal with it all, I am so damn impressed with him. And I think what this movie does so well to me is every other minute, I'm questioning how I feel and how they're trying to make me feel about, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Is he somewhere in between? Is there not an answer to this? And I think that that is what this movie did best, is present the stuff without framing it wholeheartedly as anything. It is more just presenting something that I'd be hard-pressed to imagine people watching this movie and not walking out feeling like absolute shit and feeling like things are hopeless because that's how they are. And I think that that shows the responsibility of decision and power and all the things you're doing. But even that, having that, making calls is still the wrong call sometimes, even if it's the right call. That's such a nuanced, like, difficult thing to understand, but somehow they presented it so well through the use of Albert Einstein. And that's the Nolan shit. When we get that final shot and it's color and we hear the conversation he had, oh, just what a beautiful bow to all of this of, like, damn, that was something special we just saw.
Yeah, and I think the more important thing about it was that I was worried this was going to tread into Oppenheimer is the victim here. We need to feel sorry for this man 100% throughout. Like, it was a lot more gray, like you were just mentioning, because I know that, like, when I think of American Sniper and Chris Kyle and, like, how that, like, it's like you're painting him horrifying. As like the you're painting him as like the most sympathetic figure ever, and we have to feel sorry for this man when lots of lives were lost because of this man. Like, I was worried that we were going to tread into that territory of like making him the character that we had to really, really feel sorry for. Mm. And you really just kind of feel sorry about the whole world and the whole situation. Like, yeah, you feel like garbage about everything that's happening. And I think that it was framed in a way that kind of, like you mentioned it, hey, he's not bad, he's not good. We don't know if we're going to answer this problem right now, but we're going to hit you with a line at the end of this movie that's going to really make you question everything. And I mean, I thought it was beautifully done.
That line, like the thing about like triggering the chain reaction, and it's like they built it up in this movie and like the beautiful, scary as fuck imagery of the atmosphere on fire, right? Mm-hmm. But he's talking about AI. Like, he's talking about the chain reaction that's led to where we are today.
Yeah.
It's like, God, man.
Yeah, he's talking about the arms race, the proliferation of, like, you know, the military-industrial complex, all these things that
it's
they all
like,
knew.
I want him to make happen. A Metal Gear movie.
But that's why it's so interesting, right? And that's why I think it's really smart. Yes. Like, the Oppenheimer character being as in that gray area, this could have easily dipped in the hands of a lesser director or a lesser team. This could have been propaganda. This could have been something that just came off cheesy with an all-star cast of, oh, now there's Emily Blunt. Oh, look, it's Matt Damon. Oh, is that Casey Affleck?
That's
but
why
instead
I'm,
they all what's up?
Well, I was gonna say that's why I'm so shocked about the budget. It's like, is this just one of those things, Joe, where it's like, hey, it's a Nolan movie. You get paid whatever you want. Like or you get paid whatever he's willing to pay you
you
to be in this
be
movie.
In
you just want to be in this gigantic, massive Nolan movie because
you want to work with him.
With the amount of stars that are in this movie, I'm shocked that it was $100 million because we hear movies of, hey, so and so got paid $18 million for that role, and it's like there are so many notable actors that, granted, don't have a whole lot to say all the time. Our boy Jack Quaid had about 8 lines, maybe.
He's beating those bongos, though.
Rami Malek had about, you know, 15 lines, maybe 10. Well, near the end, there was a bit more, right?
A little bit
but
more,
you see these gigantic stars that you can tell just want to be in this piece of art because of the person making it, you know?
Even Florence Pugh has, like, a
relatively
small role.
Did you guys see that article from last week with Matt Damon was talking with his wife and he was basically like they had negotiated that he was gonna take a long time off and he goes, cool, my one caveat though is if Christopher Nolan calls. And Christopher Nolan called.
Awesome.
He's like, damn it.
It's so damn cool. We're gonna continue to keep talking about this movie, but real quick, let's take a word from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Liquid IV. Y'all know how much I love to stay hydrated, and Liquid IV makes it easier and better than ever to ensure that I'm always living my best, most hydrated life. And you can too. Liquid IV, the number one powered hydration brand in America, is now available in sugar-free with 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, plus 8 vitamins and nutrients for everyday wellness. Liquid IV hydrates 2 times faster than water alone, and you can keep your daily routine exciting with 3 new flavors, white peach, green grape, and lemon lime. Let me tell you, the white peach is good. It's real good. We hear it kind of funny, swear by this stuff. 1 stick of Liquid IV in 16 ounces of water hydrates you 2 times faster and more efficiently than water alone. Real people, real flavor, real hydrating. Now sugar-free, grab your Liquid IV hydration multiplayer sugar-free in bulk nationwide at Costco or get 20% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use code kindoffunny at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order when you use promo code kindoffunny at liquidiv.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So this is a weird one to do plot for. So I don't know if you want to maybe just give the highlights overall of what this is. And I think we can just continue to keep talking about this because it's unlike... This is not so much a movie as much as it's an experience.
Yeah, there's not really a narrative back and forth as much as it is sort of a biopic that jumps back and forth through a lot of different eras.
That was really hard for me, like, to figure out, especially in the beginning, like, when, like, they do a good job of using, like, different styles and coloring to portray the different time periods, but I was just like, oh, man, like, I have to concentrate is really hard on this movie.
I needed them to say, well, Hitler's dead, To know, oh, that's where we're at.
Here's
like,
where we are.
Like, yeah. I needed the explicit facts kind of mentioned out loud because of the amount of times I'm saying, like, oh, his hair's shorter here. By the way, Cillian Murphy, the thickest head of hair I've ever seen in my life. I don't know if I saw his scalp. I don't know if he has a scalp. I don't know what's underneath there.
It's wild because...
It is dense.
He starts the movie off by talking about how, like, no light can escape a black hole. But even less light can escape his hair. Yeah. So dense.
It's just so dense.
I forget where we start, but we're I'm going to jump around. We've got a lot of different scenes that we're setting up here, not the least of which is that we meet a young Cillian Murphy. Actually, I think the first time we meet him, where he's being interviewed by the committee for his security clearance, which is a kangaroo court that we kind of catch on to very, very early. We also meet a young Oppenheimer as he's moving from America to Germany to study quantum physics and quantum mechanics and all that jazz. He also meets Kenneth Branagh there, which is going to be a character that pops up a little bit later. Has a weird moment where he almost kills his professor.
Yeah.
Which I thought was an odd thing to include in the movie, but must have been something that he really copped to, because why else would you put him putting cyanide in an apple, which is wild.
Yeah, that shit... threw me off.
Yeah.
I just did not expect that. I was like, oh, shit. And again, he's a bad guy. Like, I like that they present, at least in the terms of, like, how they're presenting it to me, where I was like, okay, cool. Like, that we're not doing this glorification thing. Like, he's a bad dude.
I think he shows his initial moral struggle with things that you see throughout the rest
of
it.
Right. Yeah.
We also meet Strauss here, who's played by Robert Downey Jr. Robert Downey Jr. is trying to get him to come and be the head of the department for his university, where Einstein happens to reside. He feeds the ducks by the park. We get a great scene where he goes and talks to him, and we get the Strauss thinks that that was where Oppenheimer was turning Einstein against them, but in reality they were having the end of a conversation they would start earlier in their lives about the computations of whether or not if they ignited the atomic bomb, or dropped it rather, would that destroy the entire world? I love the lines where, love is an interesting word for this, but I enjoyed the lines where he was like, the chances of that happening are near zero. And everyone's reaction to near zero, of is the atmosphere of the entire world going to catch on fire if this happens? Very, very fascinating.
And Einstein walked away from that much like we walked out of the theater.
Yep, 100%.
He was told the lines that were given to us at the end of, you know, I think we did make the world catch on fire.
We did destroy the world. Yeah, we started the thing that destroyed the world. The chain reaction. Very, very haunting. Very, very intense. From there, we kick over to Berkeley, which I did not know. He taught there. He was over at Berkeley, where we get to meet Josh Hartnett. Now, Josh Hartnett coming back in my life twice this week.
Watched
Black Mirror for Josh Hartnett, because he's in The Thumb. And I'm like, I haven't watched an episode of Black Mirror in a long time. It's like, Josh Hartnett, Aaron Paul, Kate Mara?
Yeah.
Sign me up. What's going on here? Haven't finished the episode yet? It's horrifying. Just FYI.
Totally.
Very, very good.
I will.
Josh Hartnett? I have a theory about this.
Ooh.
Please tell me.
Here's a conspiracy theory that I have about
He's been this. Dead the whole time.
No, I don't know why he left. He's bulking up. And I'm looking at Josh Hartnett, and I'm thinking to myself, he's got some pretty big arms. He's getting pretty jacked. I'm just thinking.
Wow.
I don't know. I don't know what's going on with Josh Hartnett, but he would make a damn good superhero.
He's an alternate universe Captain America.
I mean, I'll tell you, his Sean Hunter hair in Oppenheimer.
Beautiful.
Ooh-wee.
Beautiful.
I'm loving that shit. That nice little split going on.
Yeah. It's so cute.
Cool.
Brings back a lot of Pearl Harbor vibes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, which is weird that he was also in that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, again, you want to talk about a movie.
100%.
That is 100% the wrong tone and vibe to do it.
Yeah.
That Pearl Harbor is a great juxtaposition to this, because that is... not great. But from here we go over to Berkeley. We meet, there's a lot of themes introduced here, not the least of which is that at the time when this was happening, this was pre-World War II, communism was a big thing to talk about in the world, and it had infiltrated America. There was a Communist Party of America that a lot of people were members of. Of course, this would go on to lead a lot of people down a dark road when McCarthyism kicks in later in the 50s, when there's witch hunts all over everywhere. If anyone was ever suspected of being a communist, you would get blacklisted across the board.
Fucking insane. Like, there's so many things in history that you hear and you're like, that's fiction. But it's not. It really happened not that long ago.
Yeah. Wild.
Just wild. I don't know.
That whole era
I'm with you.
Yeah. Just like even in this movie, they deal with it, where it's like there are people like just following people, just random people.
Not,
it's like,
not people. The FBI is following them.
Exactly. Yeah.
But if Andy's following them, like, he ain't got shit.
Yeah.
What
I'm saying is, they're following random people.
Oh, yeah. They're following the FBI, following random people. Yeah. That's incredible.
If there was even a hint of communism. But it's a little stench around it. You know?
But that's what's so fascinating about this time frame. That's what's so fascinating about setting this up, right? There's a moment where obviously Matt Damon comes to recruit him, right? I'll skip around
also
here a little bit, but
performance.
Love Matt Damon.
I mean, put Matt Damon in whatever
you can't
you want.
Do wrong, man.
You can't do wrong. The mustache, it's all working for me.
He built a zoo one time.
He did. He was a little tiny guy in a bottle, too. Remember that one?
I guess he could do a little bit wrong.
Oh, downsizing was awful. So, yeah, I recant that
statement. But we bought a zoo. It was great. So.
Oh, they bought one, not built one.
Yeah, we didn't build one. They bought a pre-existing zoo.
Already prefab.
don't hurt me if you don't remember the movie, okay?
My bad.
Fascinating here, of course, he meets the writer Chevalier. He meets Florence Pugh's character as well. And they are part of the party. He helps give some money to the Spanish Liberation Front through the Communist Party, but he is not. His brother is a card-carrying member of the Communists, but he is not. He refuses to because he does not believe wholeheartedly in any dogmatic ideology. He is a scientist, and therefore he likes to remain a little neutral, but, you know, explore his options, basically.
And he's got the riz, man.
He starts an affair with Florence Pugh. She does not like flowers, and she does not like
love
him,
this little
or she
bit.
Does like him. We're not quite sure, but he's not what she's looking for. He knows that. Of course, later he'll meet Emily Blunt's character, who is married.
This is where we get the first drop of I Am Become Dead, the story.
Right. As they're reading Sanskrit, she pulls out a book, and she's like, what is this? And he goes, well, it's Sanskrit. It's an ancient Hindu text. And she's like, can you read it? He's like, I'm learning Sanskrit, as he learned German and, like, or Dutch, rather. He learned Dutch in, like, 6 months or something like that.
Which is
6 weeks. Sorry, that's where he went, not Germany, Dutch. That's where, because Kenneth Branagh's character was Dutch. So he reads the famous quote now, I am become death, the destroyer of worlds, which he was supposedly to have said after the first test in Los Alamos, the Trinity test, which, I mean, do we have to call it Trinity? Like, it's so scary. Everything they call all of these things, he's like, what are we going to call it? And he says something about the three-headed God or whatever, Trinity. I was like, stop. Yeah, like, it's too much. It's too freaking much. Yeah,
I needed a knock list in this
movie. I mean, there might as well have been one. From here, of course, Matt Damon shows up to recruit him, but he's worried that he's got ties to the Communist Party. And again, to put it in context, during this time, a lot of people, I'm sure everyone knows this. This is world history.
A little refresher.
The Soviet Union and the United States of America were allies during World War II, and we were fighting the Germans on two fronts. They were fighting from the Far East as they were approaching. We were fighting, storming the beaches of Normandy on the west, and all of these things were happening as we kind of converted upon them. But we knew. That if we won the war, the Soviets were not going to be our allies forever. And we had to keep an eye on that because the Soviet Union, we just knew they were going to be the next. They were a superpower. And once Germany was out of the equation, they were going to be a problem. And sure enough, you see everything. And of course, anyone, feel free to correct me on all these details if I'm wrong about this. This is just my very layman's understanding of World War II. But after the war kicked over, that is exactly what happened. We ignited like a 40-year Cold War with the Soviets that was largely, fueled by the arms race that Reagan would kick in later in life and then bankrupt the Russians into basically bringing down the Berlin Wall and being like, we got to rethink ourselves here. But it was scary times for everyone all
around.
But they were our allies.
Young Ocelot had the Shagohod in Russia, and Big Boss and Naked Snake were also
100%.
Oh,
all those Naked Snake, Clothed Snake,
yeah,
Tall Snake, Liquid Snake.
I hate that I know that stuff more than the real stuff. Yeah. Like, it's so not good.
There was a Plasma Snake.
Plasma.
Yeah, not a gas. He was kind of gaseous. Quasi-gas. Anyway, we move right along here. Matt Damon comes to, eventually, of course, he knows that Oppenheimer is the guy to lead his team. We have an interesting breakdown of how they're going to lead the teams in the four different cities and how it's all going to be connected with railroads, but compartmentalizing everything is the way you keep security. Of course, Oppenheimer's like, sure, no problem. Here's what I think we should do. Go to my favorite place on the planet, Los Alamos, New Mexico, and build a town that's creepy as shit. And I like the line, too, where someone's like, well, you might as well build a saloon just because it looks like an old, like, Wild West town. He recruits all of his homies. They build this very, very quickly, and off we go to the races.
I will say there's two things that took me out of this movie, and they happen around this time in that. One is that Josh Peck shows up.
He was great, though.
He was. But him, more than anyone else, I was like, you feel out of place in this cast.
The guy that got me. It's the guy that was like one of the three or four people that worked in the office at Wolf Wall Street.
Oh, I don't know.
It was like Jonah Hill, Leonardo DiCaprio, and then the little dorky guy that had the wig. He was in like two scenes in this movie. Like, it's the Wolf Wall Street guy. sorry, I interrupted
you. No, you're totally fine. The other thing that is so just off-putting about this movie is that everybody around this time starts shortening his name to Oppie.
Oppie.
Which is... it is such a serious movie and such an unserious nickname, like goofy sounding nickname.
But see, to me, I loved that because that is the going back to the gray area stuff and the cult of personality side of this mm-hmm. all. And like, this guy. You know, the
oh,
way
the, boys.
The way that they, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm. The way that they celebrate this guy and make him the face of all of this
yeah.
is like, you know, that's the burden that he has to hold. And I feel like that the lightheartedness of it, it feels real. Like that's yeah. how the shit goes. But it's like giving little cute names to good or bad people. It's going to happen when you have a group of people together, yeah. you know? So yeah, like as off-putting as it was, I feel like it really worked within the narrative they were trying to build here. And like that uneasiness where it's yeah. like, it felt uncomfortable to
yeah,
hear it.
100%.
You know?
I wanted to say also that this was, despite how loud this movie was,
so loud.
This was, I didn't have the same issues with audio mixing and like, I still think dialogue was hard to hear in this, like, but no more than a lot of other movies I've seen recently in theaters. And I think Nolan kind of maybe righted the ship there, where I think there could have been a lot of moments where the dialogue is getting completely drowned out by the just this blast, this thunderous blast of like, we are hitting you in the face with sound mm-hmm. because we want you to feel a certain way right now. And luckily, I didn't have that same dialogue issue that I had with Dunkirk or Tenet or Interstellar.
Me on super nerd audio shit, like this is easily the best mixed Nolan movie that I've seen in a theater. I've seen pretty much every Nolan movie in this exact same auditorium, so it's like it's a one-to-one reference. The unfortunate thing for this movie, a bunch of the center speakers were clearly blown.
Yeah.
So when things would that? Like, it would, I think that was the. Oh, I don't think that yeah. the movie's mixing problems were bad. I don't know, but
there was
it sounded well mixed. There were certain points of dialogue when it was a little too loud, it would clip. I was like, fuck.
Yeah.
No.
I heard there was a moment like. A legitimate kind of want to put a shoot around the world where like Robert Downey Jr. yells something and it like kind of like, you know,
yeah.
broke through that speaker. I was like, oh, Jesus.
I feel like I don't know this for sure. I'm just theorizing, but I'm pretty sure Nolan just does not like ADR. I think he just likes to try and make the audio in the scene work as much as possible. And sometimes I just don't think that works. Like there's a couple sequences when they're walking at the beginning of the movie. I'm like, what are we talking about? Like their footsteps were like louder than their voice, and I was like, "You can't just get them 80."
They're like, "What did he say?"
yeah. For me, I earlier you were talking about subtitles, Andy. I love subtitles always, but mainly because I want names and I want to be able to put stuff. I could hear what was being said. I just wish I understood who was saying it.
Yeah.
We come back and we get the team together. I want to give a shout out to Benny Safdie. Are you guys,
he was great.
He was great.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the Safdie mm-hmm. brothers? Yeah. I mean, he was great. He's amazing in this and a very, very did an accent. And I was like, yeah, didn't take me out of the movie. Good for you.
Initially, I was telling Barrett that we get a quick glimpse at him. Very, very sweaty man. And he's very sweaty the whole movie, by the way.
Yeah. He's like The Rock in Fast Five.
Initially,
Alec Baldwin's scale, how sweaty is he?
Mm. I'd say about 60%.
I would say three Departeds.
Oh, that's a lot.
We saw that just that image of him right there. If you, what I saw was the lips, and I thought, oh, Tom Hardy's wearing like prosthetics mm-hmm. or something.
Oh, you thought it was like a penguin, like where it's that? Where it's,
yeah,
yeah. What's his name in the penguin costume?
Yeah, I thought it was some sort of prosthetic situation. But then immediately I was like, oh, never mind, it's not him. It doesn't look like him. But I just saw the lips. Got the same sort of big, luscious lips.
Absolutely.
Tom Hardy has those big, kissable lips. Let me tell you what.
This went off the rails. I love the discussion here where he brings up the two jars, and he's like, this is how much plutonium we'll have to refine for both of the bombs that we're building. Do you guys know? If I'm not mistaken, I think this was Fat Man and Little Boy, the two bombs that they dropped. Yeah.
Mm.
So you could see which was represented and how big one was and how small the other one was.
And this is exactly what I was talking about give us stupid idiots something to look at to understand what's happening.
Yeah, drop it in there. Perfect visual storytelling of being like, here's where we're at in this bomb development. And you're like, that's going to take forever. And you're right. It takes 2 years and $2 billion, which in 1945 was a lot of fucking money.
Oh, yeah. And on top of that, I feel like they did a really good job of, like, setting the stage, of explaining the marbles and all that. But then the characters, their wins and losses of seeing how many they're putting in. Like, there was that one part, I forget who it was, but walks by, like, puts a couple in. And then starts putting more and more. Yeah. And you just see in the face the like, yo, let's fucking go. And it's like, this is cool, man.
They do have the conversation here about the H-bomb versus the atomic bomb, which is, that's a particular area I don't know anything about. I thought they were the same thing. I was like, isn't that the same thing? But I guess a hydrogen bomb and an atomic bomb are a completely different species of bombs. The hydrogen bomb is bigger, and that would be the one that Oppenheimer was opposed to for either various political reasons or wanted to share that information with the Soviets. And, of course, unfortunately, that ends up getting leaked to the Soviets, and that becomes the main source of trauma – or drama, rather, between Strauss and the politicians and Oppenheimer. Tim Geddes.
Major, major ignorance here.
Yeah.
Kevin, maybe you need to step in for this one. Nick, you might have this.
Science with Kev.
I'm Kevin.
The hydrogen bomb. They talk about it in this. They keep teasing it. And like, has it ever happened in real life?
I mean, I assume as much.
I don't think we've ever used it, but like,
but we have it.
There's been like tests and stuff, and it's like, yep, there it is.
I mean, yeah. At this point, 60, 70 years later, what are you, 70 years later? Yeah. We've probably developed every type of nuclear weapon that you possibly could think of. But, I mean, you see that also in the images. Like, there's a couple images at the very beginning of this movie of the ICBMs just all going up into the like, you just see the trails of them.
Yeah.
And all that stuff is just so incredibly, like, haunting and telling of what's about to come.
My gosh. Just the intro shots in IMAX of just atmosphere and sky and landscape. God damn, those were incredible just by themselves.
Has a hydrogen bomb ever been used? A hydrogen bomb has never been used in battle by any country, but experts say that it has the power to wipe out entire cities and kill significantly more people than the already powerful atomic bomb, which the U.S. dropped in Japan during World War II, killing tens of thousands of people. So yeah, we've never used one, but presumably they figured it out. Because that was the thing, too. Remember, they had that interesting conversation. Again, the science goes over my head. He's like, why don't we just do the H-bomb? And he goes, well, in order to do the H-bomb, we have to, like, refine or do something with something. We'd have to create the atomic bomb, right? What did he say, Kev?
They have to use deuterium, which is like hydrogen with an extra hydrogen isotope, I think, and essentially compress the core in a more dramatic way. And they essentially, I think, was it Tueller? The Safdie's character is like, well, you can do that with an atomic bomb, essentially. And they're like, all right, well, we have to figure out that.
We'll be doing it anyway.
Yeah. And he's like, but I love that scene too, because he's like, and how do we do that? And he's like, well, you'd have to make the atomic bomb. And he's like, cool. So we have to make the atomic bomb first. Let's come back to this. They pick their site for the dig. They start figuring that out. We go back and forth between the ballroom scene where we're talking about like who's the bad guy. It ends up being the German who was British, who I think had the best line in the entire movie. It was like, how long have you been British for? He goes, since Hitler decided I'm not German. Which was really, really interesting and sad. Of course, he ends up supposedly being accused of being a Soviet spy. I'm not sure if that person was actually the person that leaked all this information, but they get radiation tests that the Soviets are working on something that's atomic. And so, and a lot of that stuff had to have come from them because of specific science that they had developed that they can see that the Russians have. And there's no way the Russians could have caught up that well. What's incredible is when they talk about how this whole thing was kicked off by the fact that the Germans were developing this technology and had an 18-month start. And a lot of people don't realize just how technically advanced and how farther along their army was than every other army. So it's terrifying to think that if the events hadn't transpired the way they were, that Hitler could have, A, won the war, and B, started nuking all of his enemies, including us, at some point. It would have been crazy.
Yeah,
it's wild.
Scary as shit.
And a wild line there of, back and forth between Matt Damon and Cillian Murphy as Oppenheimer, where he says, well, how do we catch up? And he says, anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And he says, I'm sorry, what? And he's like, we have to hope that because of the German scientists, that there are a lot of Jewish people in the German scientist sort of regime or whatever. We have to hope that Hitler is so anti-Semitic and he has so much hate in his heart that he, kind of like stops their studies and doesn't like fund them enough or whatever. And that sequence enough was like, God damn, man, I'm learning so much in this movie that I didn't fucking remember anything from school.
I didn't either.
Yeah, it's absolutely wild. Of course, somewhere along here, Hitler actually loses the war as they're in development before the Trinity test kicks off, which begs the question and starts really getting into the moral like fiber of what this movie is about. We have that great scene where I forget her name, but she was in Dread 3D. She plays one. You know what I'm talking about? Olivia Thirlman or something
I don't know.
One female physicist.
Yeah, she came in. She's like, this guy's gonna turn me away because I can't type. And he's like, you don't have to type. She's like, I didn't learn that when I was studying like chemistry at Berkeley or whatever it is. They just have that great scene where they're talking about like Olivia Thirlby. Yeah, that's her name. Go watch Dread 3D. It was awesome.
Dude, yeah. Should do an interview for it.
This is the question that is posed in the movie. It's like, should they ever use this? Should they continue? Now that the war is over, should they continue developing this? And of course, Oppenheimer knows that the second it was put into the world that this thing could possibly exist, it was going to be a race to see who could do it first. Little did he know that it was going to be no matter what happened. Because I think they have that great line with the Soviets too, where he's like, well, they're not. Truman's like, they're not going to do that. They don't have any resources. And he's just like, yeah, they are. They have to. They don't have a choice.
I know.
Because if we have it, they have to have it. Basic human survival, like, nature of our enemies have a spear, I need a gun. They got a gun, I need a howitzer. It's just that escalation of all these things that we inevitably saw throughout the eras of you skip to the 80s and you're seeing missile silos everywhere with intercontinental ballistic nuclear missiles.
Totally. And, it, you know, it's something that going back to Nolan's strengths as a writer and a storyteller, like, this is the same concept of the end of Batman Begins, where he's talking to Batman about this guy that dresses like a clown. Mm-hmm. And it's like
escalation.
We start the escalation, all that stuff. And that is obviously the value of superheroes, is able to tell complex stories using these like fun characters. But for him to now take all of that and apply it to this real thing and like what that's all based on, I just thought they did such a great job with it and keeping with the tone of like not sensationalizing any of this and not making it too movie-esque. The way that like Hitler dies off screen. Like, it's not this, like, epic moment. Like, we don't get a Hitler cameo. Like, they don't do that. And I thought that was, like, such a wise call. And I feel was very, very, very in service of the story that they're telling here and keeping the focus on these scientists. And they just get this information and have to deal with, like, okay, so do we need to keep doing this? Mm-hmm. I mean, we do. And that conversation, I think, was so much more powerful without the, like,
Gimmick.
And like, I don't even want to call it a gimmick because those things happened. Yeah. Right.
Well, I think it could have been cheap. I think it could have felt cheap.
Yes. Yeah. I thought they did a really good job handling that.
And I think it was made even stronger by the fact, like, you know, again, just sort of delivered off screen, or not off screen, but Hitler dies off screen. We're delivered that line of, well, Hitler's dead and we're still kind of studying here. We're still here in Los Alamos. And then to get that moment of, you know, we'll get to it later or whatever, but after they have the successful tests or whatever, and they have the quote-unquote successful bombings, and him being up there going, just wish we had the bombs when Germany was, you know, like, I think all of that sort of lends back to, you know, that feeling of, you know, wow, we really didn't need to do what we did.
Yeah.
and it, I think it adds to sort of the it really puts you in the headspace of Oppenheimer during those moments of like, god damn it, right now he is trying to be this leader and he's just trying to survive mentally, because you are watching him I feel like every once in a while we would cut to him and it was like
he's breaking
mid
down.
Breakdown.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, that scene was beautifully done, right? You want to talk about like sound design that should win an Academy Award. When they just drop moments of sound out of it, so everyone stands up, you can't hear them, and you just hear like their feet shuffling, but they're like screaming, and then you look over and someone's crying just for a second. All of that stuff was just so incredibly well done.
I mean, dude, like, yeah, the sound design in this movie needs to win so many awards, and it's going to.
Yeah.
But I thought that scene was so brilliantly done. We'll talk more about sound later when it comes to the bomb itself and all that, but the kind of like the dun-dun-dun of people like stomping their feet on the bleachers and things like that. As tense as that was and scary as it felt and intimate and close and claustrophobic, like it sounded claustrophobic and it was backed up with the visuals. But the fact that we've heard that sound for 2 hours before this in the movie, where they were just
peppering
it in
and
we don't know what it is. And they play that same sound off like it could be a slowed down version of the ticking clock, but they also play it like it's the train tracks that they're putting the bomb on and talking about all that stuff. And I just feel like the multi-use of that sound and then the reveal of what it is, oh my God, the storytelling of the sound design alone was like, I don't know that I've ever seen anything like that. That was so, like, this is a masterpiece. This is fucking art at its best.
We're not quite there yet, though, of course. We have to get to the climax of this movie, which happens 2 hours in, where they're like, we need to know if this thing's going to work. And so they set up the Trinity test, which is where they're going to drop their first atomic bomb. They're taking bets, as you would if you were incredibly nervous and terrified. And they're joking around about, and someone has a side bet on that whole, is it going to ignite the entire world thing? And Matt Damon's like, hey, what did he mean by that? He goes, oh, we thought there was a near zero chance that we might destroy the entire world. He's like, is there?
however many months paycheck or whatever it was.
Yeah.
There was some moments here that I did feel like were a little movie-esque with Matt Damon. And this probably comes from ignorance, but like, I was a little lost on the like, him being like, we got to do this. We got to do this test as soon as we can get it out there. It's like, you know, we're dealing with the fucking bomb here, man. Like, maybe slow down just a bit. I know that there was the timeline of like, we got to get to Russia. We got to tell the president XYZ. And like, we need to prove this first. But like, there was just something, I don't know. I feel like there was not enough fear about the people that were directly around this untested bomb. But
well, they didn't. I mean, historically, they just didn't know. That like there's stories of when they tested in the ocean and they had like they did bomb tests in the ocean and you see like battleships that are like a mile away and all those guys got like horrible radiation poisoning and things like that. So they just that's another theme in the movie where it's like Josh Hartnett even talks about it. He was like, oh, we did that thing.
The theory.
Like, what are you talking about? Like theory versus practice of doing something. You just we'll never know. But man, how wild is it where they're like, oh, here's your little glass you look through, and by the way, look that way, and then when you see the flash, you can look back at it. It's like, knowing what we know now, I'd be like, I'll be in the next state over.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah,
you put a
just
camera up, I'll be watching from
to absorb the impact.
Yeah, it's wild, right? I think they were laying on the mattresses so they didn't get like blown back.
Yeah.
And then Oppenheimer like sitting in his bunker and having the glasses and all that stuff, and then people just watching, like literally watching this, like it's going to be a fireworks display.
Our boy Jack Quaid.
Jack Quaid with the bongos. best line in the movie where Benny's putting on the UV screen. He's like, "What about that?" He goes, "No." Taps the windshield glasses. Like that'll filter out the UV. Which I'm like, "How would you know? You're a scientist. Yeah, you would probably know that. That makes a lot of sense." I don't know. Glass did that, but that's
and then
cool.
He said, "What's going to block the glass?"
yeah, that was crazy.
crashing into your face.
Good call. And Joey mentioned earlier about Christopher Nolan building tension very, very well. I think this movie's special for that, not because it builds tension on whether or not the bomb's going to work. We know the bomb works.
Mm-hmm.
If you know history, you know at some point they detonate this damn bomb. You know it's the tension that comes from the fact that you don't want it to work. You want these people to fail. You don't want history to have been what it was, and it is, and it's faded. And that's what you feel. That's what you felt this entire movie leading up to this point, whether you knew it or not, right?
It's
even Oppenheimer knew it. It was like, shit, I know. He saw exactly what was going to happen for the rest of the world, like when they asked him to do this project.
The only other director I feel like that does this is James Cameron, Titanic, where it's like, it's historical, you know what the ending is, but you're like hoping and wishing.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But the difference is, and I'm so right there with you, obviously on that, like that is an apt comparison, but they had to make that a romance to make us want the disaster to not happen. I mean, of course, we don't want the people to die and all that, but it's like they had to like make up this fantastical story where we're rooting for them and like maybe they'll get away, maybe it'll work. Yeah. Whereas with this, it's like we're just hoping it doesn't happen. And it,
like the soul of humanity.
There's no romance in this movie. I mean, there's romantic characters, but I mean, like, it's not like a romantic plot. It's not like...
Not even... Barely a subplot.
There's not characters you're rooting for.
Yeah.
Well, it's not... But it's not a romantic plot in that. Like, I mean, there's the Kitty plot, but there's also the Florence Pugh plot where she is either commits suicide and or is killed by the FBI. Because there's a moment where someone's gloves.
Yeah.
And I thought that was...
His imagining. He's imagining what happened.
I thought that was him imagining what the possibilities could have been. Yeah.
Because
I think it was he was trying to not blame himself. Because it was like if she did kill herself, it like he was like, I did it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But all of those aren't necessarily romantic subplots. They just sort of go to back up the who Oppenheimer was and unfortunately the many different sins that he has committed in his past to lead him toward his ultimate ruination, which we'll see in the third act of this movie. But either way, we gotta talk about again, you want to talk about the sound design for the bomb. This thing, I'm thinking this thing's going to blow your ears out, and it's dead silent.
Oh, my God.
You just hear the breathing. Well, I mean, they teased us in many moments with showing the delayed explosion because of the distance or whatever, and I thought that stuff was always done really well, and you know that they're much further away this time, and we're going to hear that blast at one point.
Yeah.
But they let you sit in that silence with just the close-up breath of Cillian Murphy hearing the vibrations in his breath because of how nervous all these people are, and you just sat there in this theater silent listening to a man breathing, knowing that this thing worked and this thing is going to work again in some other point.
And then of course moments later the shockwave hits And that, of course, is metaphorical for the shockwave that's about to hit the entire world, and now nothing will ever be the same again. And you see it with everyone. It's like some people are like, we did it. And then once the blast hits, they're like, oh, shit. Like, it's almost as if the magnitude of everything they had done for the last few years just came crashing back in on them, which very much it did. But either way, it is a success. And now the question is, well, we can't use it against Germany. What do we do? Do we use it? We have to use it against Japan to end the war because, quote, the Japanese will never give up the war. This is a, I assume, a very much debated thing throughout the history of our countries, our two countries, as to whether or not Japan really would have dug in that hard, or if eventually we could have gotten them to give up a different way because Germany was already out of the war, but the Pacific campaign was still happening. But either way, Truman decided to drop not one, but two bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
We will lose a lot of troops kind of doing...
They'll lose a lot of troops. We'll lose a lot of troops, right?
There will be a lot of dead people. This will save a lot of lives.
Right. But this is, to me, the most fascinating debate of the entire movie, in that we're not going to get into it now. The concept of, did we drop it because we really did think it was the best thing to end the war? Or realistically, did we drop it because we wanted to show the Soviets, who we knew were going to be our main enemy, that we had this big bad power that Truman thought they would never get? And that scene is obviously mirrored when Oppenheimer gets called in to be thanked by Truman, played by Gary Oldman, who I didn't know was in this movie. Yeah. God. And Oppenheimer has that great line where he's like, I have blood on my hands. And Truman just takes out his handkerchief, hands it to him,
bitch, dude.
And tells him, and you see it for one moment where he's like, do you think the people in Nagasaki give a shit who made the bomb or who dropped it? He's like, and then he's like, never let that motherfucker back in this place ever again.
Crybaby, yeah.
But you see it for a moment where he's like, Gary Oldman has a great moment where he's like, you think you got blood on your hands? I'm the one that pushed the button. Like, you made the thing, but I'm the one that ultimately decided to use it, so I got the blood on my hands for the rest of my life. Great, riveting scene. And it's out, and it's there. And then we start sort of the third act of this movie, I would say.
I mean, we don't, again, in the same way we don't see Hitler, we don't see the bombing.
No.
And, like...
Nor do we need to. We see Oppenheimer, again, another telling moment for him. Once the bombs are loaded and it's done, he realizes he has that moment of realizing, oh, no, I'm out. I'm no longer the guy.
It happened so fast. I loved that. I love how it's like they do the test and it's literally like, all right, cool, we're passing it on. And then they're like, peace, you're good, we don't need you anymore, we're done. And then all of a sudden it happens. And I'm like, that it just adds to the tension and the frenetic pacing of the movie, but also like the events of like, that's how quick this superpower is out of the hands of the creator, of the people that actually understand it. And it's now in the hands of people that are ready to use it. Like, that's so scary.
And that was, I think, echoed and mirrored right near the beginning of the movie when Oppenheimer's very confident about his place in all of this. And I'm a genius and I run this place. I run Los Alamos, and saying like, they need us. And I forgot who he's talking to, but he says, but until they don't. And holy shit. Like,
but then it's
off. And that's exactly how it worked out, you know?
Yep.
But it didn't, because there's the conversation where he's like, so what are we going to do with Los Alamos now? And he's like, well, give it back to the Native Americans, basically. It's their land anyway. And he goes, give it back.
Well, before you done.
We got to build this shit out. Yeah. We're about to kick out more of these things.
You said the Soviets are going to build against us. Yeah. We got to
build against them, right? And you're like, here we go. This is it. But we also get now we get into these like little minor courtroom scenes that are orchestrated by Strauss.
Well, first we get the success story in quotes of
the father of the atomic bomb,
you know,
Time magazine.
No, but it's him delivering his speech to everybody there at Los Alamos, with those sort of very haunting sounds of everybody cheering. And then those practical effects of behind Oppenheimer, the wall is shaking and there's a blast outside.
So
like
badass.
All that stuff was done so, I think, kind of just perfectly, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we already talked about the sound design of that scene and all of it, but like this scene is like going to go down in history as just one of the all timers.
Yeah,
like,
that's where I went to the bathroom.
Oh my god. It's absolutely wild. Like the way that they played with the reality versus what he's thinking about.
I saw the tail end of it.
Going back and forth between the two and where it starts and ends. Like him being out there in this very church looking setting is obviously there's adding a lot of that there, that it just adds this uneasy feeling. Him there celebrating, but you could tell he doesn't want to celebrate with both what he's saying, how he's saying it, how he's reacting to it, the practical wall shaking, all that stuff. But him looking out into the crowd, the way that they cut out any sounds that weren't just like
the stepping of stuff. It was very very eerie. Like, I don't know any other way to
put
it.
Eerie.
But he'd be looking around and seeing people burning or like stepping on charred corpses and all this stuff that obviously that wasn't real. That wasn't there. And then you see people like kissing and making out, celebrating. But then you also see people crying. And the way that they blended, this is the reality. And then this is clearly not reality. This is just what he's thinking about. But then he goes outside and the guy throws up. And it's like, that's real.
Yeah.
Like, I loved that like balance between, oh my God, he's not just seeing this. These people are being so affected by this that they're physically throwing up because they know what they did.
Yeah.
They know that the blood is on their hands with all this. It's like, oh my God, Nolan, you did it here.
Yeah.
And and I think all the visuals there were just so perfectly done. We get that big blinding white light as well. And then, you mentioned the lady in the front row and her skin is being, she's clapping along and her skin is just being burned
torn off.
And
like,
oh
off.
My gosh.
Very, very terrifying and well done scene. From there, now we really kick off the juxtaposition between the security clearance meeting, which Strauss has orchestrated so that Oppenheimer can lose his security clearance and then basically be discredited and disgraced so that he can now he doesn't want him to comment or be a part of what he knows is coming next, which is going to be this massive arms race and this thing that, you know, he doesn't want him talking at all about being the atomic guy anymore. He wants to discredit him.
So this is the point in the movie that it turns into Christopher Nolan, baby.
This
and we start getting these like, hey, all those cameo characters that you thought were cameo characters throughout the movie, nah, motherfuckers. They've been pulling the strings the whole time. Robert Downey Jr. has a plan, and here's the plan. And they did the Iron Man 3 thing of like, hey, remember that scene? Nope. Actually, if you look over here, this guy was there the whole time. And it could have been corny and not worked, and it was riveting, and it just added so much context and layers to everything we'd seen before it, and it answered the question we were all asking of how the fuck is there an hour left in this movie beautifully.
We go back and forth between that and the other scene with great actors. I think Jason Clarke is the guy's name from Terminator.
He was excellent.
He's great. He's the main prosecutor here. This is a kangaroo court. They don't even let the guy, the defense attorney, see any of the information that's happening. They're totally getting the runaround.
It's not conviction. It's what's the word? It's not declassification.
He'll lose the security clearance, right? He'll be basically like, he won't have his
denial.
Deconsecrated.
Of course, they put him through the ringer. They make him confess to his affair with Florence Pugh. Emily Blunt has a great scene where they're like, we're going to make her sort of testify, I guess. And she kind of gives it back to him for a little bit. If I'm being honest, after Emily Blunt did her thing, I went to the bathroom here because I was like, this scene's getting a little long, and it's very intense, and they're talking about a lot of characters and a lot of moments and a lot of things that I don't think we need. Because the point of the scene was really to jam at home that they were screwing him. But I think we got there with minute 10. At minute 30, I was like, we could have cut a little bit of this out, and I think it would have still had the same impact, and added it maybe to the Senate commission, because Strauss is trying to become a cabinet member. He's trying to be confirmed to be a part of a cabinet for, I think, Eisenhower. I would have liked that fleshed out a little bit more, because to me that kind of felt like the Alden Ehrenreich character was just kind of thrown in there, and then they'd be like, hey, see, I got you, or whatever. that he was the one character that I felt was like, oh, this takes me out of it just a little bit, because he just exists to be like, gotcha. And you're like, well, who are you? What was the point of this character at all?
He threw me off so much because most of the scenes he's in are black and white. So it's like a little bit, I was like,
is that
Leonardo DiCaprio? No, I was like, that doesn't make any sense at all. Uh-huh. But I was like, it looks like it's slightly de-aged, but I'm like, I don't think Nolan would do that. And then eventually I was like, it's Han fucking Solo.
Yeah. Yeah.
By the end of this,
I did
of course,
really like Matt Damon's line in this whole thing where they ask him, like, I don't remember what the question is exactly, but
would
like,
do you
hold him accountable in some, or would you recommend him? And he says no, and then you see the reaction to it, and he's like, but that's all of them. Like, it's very clear. This is the gray area of like the rules that we played by at that point are different than the rules we're playing by now. And like, it's unfair to hold them to these standards when we're moving the goalposts.
Yeah. He made it clear that like, well, all of that was happening before this act took place, before we put in the whatever nuclear atomic arms act of 19, whatever the hell, the pepperoni diplomacy act of 2019. Like, I really enjoyed that line of dialogue, but like they didn't care. Like, all they heard was that first piece of dialogue. Like, no, I would not recommend him. And then, but I wouldn't recommend any of them. And you cut back to him, and he's like, don't give a shit, man. Like,
yeah,
you said all we needed to
but hear. You see the politics behind it too, right? You see that everyone's like, oh, I know where this is going.
And it's all
like,
about the game and hype.
Why bother throwing him under the bus when he's already firmly under the bus? Like, I'll say he saves his career basically by being like, I'm not going to stand up for him, but tries to clarify at the end there. Good on Matt Damon.
Interesting too that Josh Hartnett had that moment where he walked saw them in. Yeah. And then turned around.
Yeah. Oh, see, I missed that. That's when I went to the restroom.
Oh, yeah. There, it's
Bernard
Oppenheimer and Bernard, yeah, in the hallway.
Well, Bernard.
He had gotten lied to, right? Well, not lied to, but like he was essentially told by the Strauss, hey, this guy, or Oppenheimer, hooked up with this dude's wife, and eventually that's the reason the guy died.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then Oppenheimer jokingly is like, he never found out about that.
Yeah. Wow. You can't die of a broken heart because he never knew.
Yeah.
Dang.
What a perfectly, like, stoically delivered line by
Cillian Murphy.
Oppie. Whereas we press, the court doesn't go well. He gets his security clearance revoked, and basically is gone now. He's out of the public eye, and they're like, you're done. He's been ousted from the community.
Do you have any ties with the Communist Party? Just leave me alone, bro.
Yeah, all right, that's happening. Just as Strauss is supposed to be confirmed, but then Rami Malek's character comes in and basically says, yo. He did all this to Oppenheimer. The scientific community is not like this. Shout out to Matthew Modine, also had a great scene in amongst here as well. And basically Strauss is like, damn it, didn't think it was going to happen. He gets, he does not make it to the cabinet. He unfortunately is ousted as well. And so both men have, what's up?
But the moment when his aide walks in and he's like, do we have the votes or not? And he's like, yeah, it looks like you're going to just squeak by, but you're going to win. And he's like, all right, call the press.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he does not make it by because JF Kennedy didn't like what he did.
What a fucking name drop.
What a reveal.
This young senator from Massachusetts, what's his name? Kennedy something. Robert. Yeah.
God damn.
JFK. So from there, of course, Strauss talks about, and the entire time Strauss is talking about like the, basically
that was
the,
like, oh, I,
the
really
source
quick,
of his beef.
That was just like the corniest moment you could have had, but it was still awesome.
100%.
That was like the, oh, his name was Nick Fury. Like that sort of thing.
There's two moments. There's this, and then way earlier in the movie, when they first get to Alamos, he's all like wearing like military outfit, and then they're like, dude, you look ridiculous. Like, come on, don't do that shit. And then they
be who you are.
Be who you are. They give him the hero edit. Like the music kicks in, and we get the shots of like all of Oppenheimer's different like fuck. He's putting on his jacket and shit, putting on the
hat. It's like, and the pipe.
So fucking funny, man.
Have you told the story about Indiana Jones and your nephew?
we were at the Universal tour, the Universal Studios tour, and we had just gotten on the Indiana Jones ride the day before. My nieces and nephew had no idea who Indiana Jones was, but now they knew because we rode the ride. And the next day, we're on the Universal Studios tour, and big poster of Oppenheimer. My nephew's like, "Oh, Indiana Jones." And I was like, no, that's not it.
Slightly different.
He's like, oh, the hat. Yeah. I was like, no, not the same guy.
Right before Strauss was ousted, he reveals the source of his beef with Oppenheimer. One was like a hearing where Oppenheimer talked about isotopes. And he was like, that's silly. And he's dumb. And he doesn't know shit about isotopes. And then the other, of course, was he thinks that Oppenheimer turned Einstein against him during that conversation. Of course, we go over to the conversation. It was anything but. Einstein is talking to him about, he was like, they're going to throw you a party one day when all this is over. And they're gonna thank you and they're going to forgive you. But they're not really, it's not really about you. It's about them. It's about basically them like trying to assuage their own guilt. And they're going to give you awards and tell you everything's great because they don't want. Sorry, let's move on there. I figured that was going to be the case.
Yes.
They don't, you know, they don't want to deal with the magnitude of their own, you know, failure as well. And we see this happening. We see him older. We see Emily Blunt. We see Emily Blunt refuse to shake Benny Softy's hand because he threw them under the bus back in the day. And then it ends with Oppenheimer, as Einstein's about to walk away, he picks up his hat and hands it back to him and says, you know, that thing we thought was going to happen if we ignited the bomb, that it was going to basically start a chain reaction that destroyed the whole world. It did.
Oh,
that is
God.
The end of Oppenheimer.
And some lady screamed, "Fine!" Or thank God.
Yeah, she's like, finally.
I didn't hear that at all. On
yeah.
Really?
Some lady
that bugged me so much.
Right when it cut to
I was like,
black,
go watch Shrek.
Some lady said, thank God. Like, either like, thank God it's over
it was the
or whatever.
Movie.
And I was like, I always do that. I've been doing the thing where, like, at the end of the movies, I'll leave when I know the movie's about to end, just like get to the restroom faster.
It stresses me out every time, Andy. Every fucking time. I see you getting up, and I'm like,
I was just standing near the hallway and just kind of watch. But yeah, she said, I was so close to being like, shut up. Shut up there.
Oh, yeah. There it is.
Ragu, everybody. Nuclear war, you know.
So here's the thing. This is Christopher Nolan interview. A long time ago, we did this show.
Mm-hmm.
We had Ragu Bagu. We started it, and very quickly we realized there's usually not even bad guys in this movie. So we instead have Ragu Goo Goo, the Ragu good guys.
Okay.
Who the fuck are we putting on this
Which at
list?
Some point in Nolan interview, we realized we need to rename because they're not necessarily good guys some of the time.
Yeah.
So it's just, I forgot what we called about Ragu Pro Tag.
Oh, Ragu Pro Tag.
Something like
that's
that.
Right.
Ragu so Proto. Let me.
I can't wait to hear this list.
Let What's me read to us? You the list so far for Ragu Pro Tag. In first place, we have All Right, All Right, All Right from Interstellar.
Yep.
Perfect.
Oh, McConaughey.
And number two, we have Batman and the Wolverine from The Prestige.
Oh, that was unexpected. Yeah.
Number Perfect. Three. And by the way, the Dark Knight trilogy are not included in this ranking of the Ragu Pro Tags.
Right.
Okay. Number three, we have Cobb Salad from Inception.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Leonardo DiCaprio's character was named Cobb.
Yeah. Cobb. There you go, Cobb. This movie was actually missing Michael Caine.
Oh, it was missing Michael Caine. Nice.
Yeah. Sure was.
I don't like that. Number four, the protagonist.
Oh, from Memento? Tenet.
Oh, from Tenet. Oh.
Yeah, Tenet.
Whose name was the protagonist. Number five, Lenny from Memento.
Great guy, super guy.
Number six, Hoo-ah from Insomnia.
Yes, I forgot he did Insomnia. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Number seven, the incredibly, incredibly young boy from Following.
Know what any of these mean, but these names are very funny.
You don't have to worry about it, Joey. Plausible.
Do you guys remember why that is what it was?
I do not.
I'm pretty sure the character's name is Young Man.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
He just kept getting younger and younger every time we
just tied him like a young boy.
Yeah. Psycho.
And then number eight, Watermelon Sugar from Dunkirk.
The styles.
Yeah. So where do we want to rank
Cillian Murphy? Yeah, Oppie. I mean, I gotta say number one.
I mean, legitimately,
character.
I feel like for what this list is of just ranking the protagonist of the movie, like what it's about, I don't know how you get much better than this. I mean, Matthew McConaughey, I don't want to take away from that because, like, goddamn, what a performance.
Oh,
that was
yeah.
Incredibly moving. Like, yeah, the acting and all that was great. But I think that the amount that Cillian had to own in this movie and, like, scenes that were just him, and even when every other actor was bringing their best, he was right there with them. Like, there's something special about this. Now, I put it at number one.
Are we ranking the character or the actor?
Both.
It's a little bit of both.
It's
tough.
This is tough. That's because I love Matthew McConaughey. I love Batman and Wolverine in The Prestige.
Yeah, it's tough because...
You don't know? The Knot, remember that?
Mm, I do.
Which Knot was it? Which Knot was it, Borden? Oh, no, somebody says the wrong
thing. That's really good. Is that your Christian Bale?
Langford Thabo.
Thank you.
That was really good. Interstellar, one of my favorite movies. Definitely, I think Matthew McConaughey's best role. Hard not to... I watched that movie. He is absolutely riveting in that.
Oh, my God.
But for a totally different reason... I don't know. Maybe, you know,
I go number one because he's literally the title, and I feel like they succeeded at what they were doing.
Matthew McConaughey's last name character wasn't a song.
God damn it, you beat me to it. You're right.
You feel it. Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's hard. I say we just vote.
I'd go with two.
I would go with two also.
I'm gonna go with one, but that doesn't really help us here.
Yo, hey, it's okay. We can tie here.
No, it's definitely number one.
Oh, there it is.
Kev's coming in. Kev's coming in there. Kev's coming in. We got Oppenheimer.
I just think that with Oppenheimer, we get character development over like such a longer period of time that I think I like. I think that it's more riveting to me.
Time's relative, though, Joey.
I guess that is true. God, fucking Miller's planning.
He's using a dubbo, isn't he? He's not using a dubbo.
Remember this? I don't have a finger.
Oh, wow.
I cut my finger off. That's so my impression good. Of Christian not, Bale.
You nailed it. You nailed it. All right, now it's time to rank the Christopher Nolan movies. This includes the Dark Knight trilogy. Currently number one, The Dark Knight. Two, Interstellar. Three, Inception. Four, Batman Begins. Five, Tenet.
What?
Six, The Prestige.
This is
seven,
such
The
a
Dark Knight
crazy
Rises. Eight, Memento. Nine, Dunkirk. 10, Following. And 11, Insomnia.
This list is pretty great.
This list is pretty great.
Tenet above The Prestige.
I don't know. I think I got railroaded on that. I didn't like Tenet.
It's a really good movie, Joey.
There's a good
Joey, you get it. The T, if you spell it the opposite way, it's the T still there.
It's a Tenet.
Tenet.
Yeah.
There's a good chance I did, but I'm mad about it now. That's what happened last time, Joey.
I hold you personally responsible.
I was like, who the fuck put Quantumania that high? I was like, oh, my bad. I would put Oppenheimer. Oh, God, how can I put it? I can't put it above The Prestige. I enjoy The Prestige much more as a... I'm going to put it at number 7.
Oh!
Underneath The Prestige.
Hey-o!
Yeah.
Hey-o!
That's exactly where I put it.
Whoa!
Exactly where I put it. Good Lord. Christopher Nolan, debatably the greatest of all time. You look at this list of movies, and man, we have some absolute bangers. I think that the Dark Knight Rises and below on this list, all fantastic movies, but... I feel like don't have that level of for Prestige or whatever it is. Prestige.
Yeah.
But yeah, from I think 6 up. Tenet, like I need to rewatch it. Only seen it the one time. Really enjoyed it. Don't think it hit the highs of the more gimmicky, high level thinking that of my favorite type of Nolan movies, like the Inceptions and Interstellars, or the Dark Knight movies, which I think are just so goddamn good. So yeah, I'd put this at number 7 just because the more historical based things like this and Dunkirk aren't my favorite cup of tea. But I do feel like despite all of that, this is a masterpiece of a film. Number 7.
Nick, what are you thinking?
I would put it a little higher. I didn't particularly care for Tenet. So this is one of those things where it's like I like The Prestige, but I didn't care for Tenet.
Yeah.
Where do I want to put this? I think just based on the merits of the acting and the cinematography alone and the fact that in the sound design, I got to put this a little bit above it. So I would probably put this number 5. Put this right below Batman Begins. I think this movie is just a massive accomplishment for a biopic, and I think it is very, very good.
Yeah, I actually am like perfectly with him and Andy.
Okay.
I think on my personal list, Oppenheimer is going to rank higher than 7 because I'm going to rearrange the top stuff, the top half of this. But I think with Dunkirk, I think these are both movies that are, at least Oppenheimer, I think I agree with you that this is like required viewing, but this is not one that has high rewatchability compared to everything else above it for me, except for Tenet. But
yeah. Kev, I want to give you like the ranking is here. We number 7. We have Oppenheimer here, but Kev, I know you really, really enjoyed this one. You want to talk about it for a sec?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love this movie. I was utterly blown away by just everything about it, like the cinematography, the editing. This movie was so fast. Like I looked at my watch just to be like, I can't believe like how much. Like, how long has passed?
Yeah.
And I was utterly shocked. I was literally on the edge of my seat. I was enthralled. Yeah. I, like, scooted forward so much just because, like, everything about this movie worked for me. And, like, I am going into this movie. I caught Barrett outside of the movie theater, and we were talking for a minute. And I was like, yeah, I haven't seen a serious, like, a non-science fiction Nolan movie in so long. He's like, oh, Dunkirk was pretty good. And he said that, and I was like, oh, I totally forgot Dunkirk was a thing. And that kind of, just for a moment, I was like, I didn't love the tone of that movie, and I hope this isn't that. And it wasn't. Like, this movie blew me away. The casting is, every aspect of it is insane. I think that walking out of the movie theater, I said, this is definitely one of my favorite movies. And I think this is my favorite Nolan film now.
Whoa. Yeah.
Dang.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
That's awesome. Let us know in the comments below if you haven't seen the movie yet, if you're excited to watch it, and if you have seen it, what you thought about it. And then remember, like I've been saying, we have Barbie next week. Please tune in for that one. Patreon.com/kindoffunny to watch it on Monday. Otherwise, Tuesday for everyone else. We're going to have so much fun with it. We have some fun things planned.
You guys don't even know yet.
And then
I don't even know.
The week after that, we got Secret Invasion with the whole crew. It's going to be a great time. Can't wait to see you through all of that. But until next time, I don't know.
Wow.